like we could just end there, because this is, I feel fed. There's been so many lovely things between bees sharing and the music and everything, but I did spend time preparing this, so we'll give it a shot. One of these things is not like the other. One of these things doesn't belong. Can we tell which thing is not like the other by the time I finish this song? Now, I didn't get the melody quite right, but if you know the lyrics, you've probably watched Sesame Street. And you've probably seen the segment where they compare things that are, one of them's not like the other. Three red balloons and a blue one. An apple, a baseball, a marble, and a book. Which one of those things doesn't belong? There's a simple cognitive process involved, right? About sorting objects and creating awareness about similarities and differences. Healthy and appropriate development for toddlers and little ones. But by the time most kids reach middle school, the developmental awareness of similarities and differences takes on a much more challenging and complex tone. Teenagers become incredibly aware of similarities and differences, and the song becomes much less exciting. One of these kids is not like the others. One of these kids doesn't belong. Can we tell which kid is not like the other by the time one's walked in the door? Shame researcher Brené Brown compares belonging to fitting in by saying that, quote, belonging is being accepted for you. Fitting in is being accepted for being like everyone else. I get to be me if I belong. I have to be like you to fit in. And who knows this better than teenagers, who often face incredible peer pressure to fit in when they are desperately trying to figure out who they are and desperately trying to belong all at the same time. And so belonging is a gift I hope we can offer them and every person of all ages in our church community. The gift of knowing that they are loved just the way they are. Now, this gift that we give each other of belonging doesn't mean that we don't challenge each other sometimes and name what we perceive to be difficult or unacceptable behavior. It doesn't mean that anything goes and we can treat each other however we want. It does mean that we understand each other to be imperfect human beings who make mistakes. And we know that we are fully loved here, just as we are in our imperfection. That's the message in Corduroy, our story for all ages this morning, right? Lisa bought Corduroy, picked him over all the others, despite the missing button on his overalls. She loved him just the way he was. This gift of unconditional love is true to our universalist heritage. The universalists believe that everyone was saved, that no one went to hell, everyone goes to heaven, because God loves us all no matter what. And while many of us Unitarian Universalists today have moved away from belief in God, the underlying theology remains true. Each of us is loved just the way we are, no matter what. Whether that's God's love or the love of this gathered community is in some ways less than important. What is important is the belonging. You belong here whether you've been a member for 45 years or whether this is your first time visiting us today. You belong here. You are loved just for who you are. And actually, I'd like us all to say it out loud together right now. We're going to say, I am loved just as I am with all my imperfections. I am loved just as I am with all my imperfections. And I wonder how that felt for you as you said it. Did it ring true? Did it ring hollow? Was there maybe a part of you that resisted or argued? Because I'll tell you, for me, that's a hard message to let sink in. I felt like I've needed to earn my love and worthiness for most of my life, and despite my head knowing better, my heart has believed my unworthiness to be true for a very long time. My heart believed this despite my UU upbringing, despite being raised from as far back as I can remember with our first principle that each human being has inherent worth and dignity. We Unitarian Universalists don't make a lot of truth claims, but that's just a really important one that we do make. Each and every one of us has inherent worth and dignity,
each and every one of us is worthy of love. So belonging somewhere, having places where we are loved just for who we are, is vitally important to our sense of well-being. We need it, our spirits need it, that sense of belonging if we're to feel healthy and whole. What's interesting, though, is that belonging is not just a passive experience. It's not just a one-way street. This was highlighted for me in a multi-day workshop that I participated in, one put on by the UU Ministers Association called Whose Are We? The workshop was inspired by the following quote from Quaker teacher Douglas Steer, who said that the ancient question, what am I, inevitably leads to a deeper one, whose am I? Because there is no identity outside of relationships. You can't be a person by yourself, he says. To ask whose am I is to extend the questions far beyond the little self-absorbed self and wonder, who needs you? Who loves you? To whom are you accountable? To whom do you answer? Whose life is altered by your choices? With whose life, whose lives, is your own all bound up inextricably in obvious or invisible ways? And so I got to spend 3 days with colleagues wrestling with the question, whose are we? As well as with the question, whose am I? And I have to tell you, I was not at all on board with this at the beginning. Because I felt like the question implied ownership, like I was supposed to be belonged to or owned by some group or someone else. And let me tell you, no one owns me. But over the course of those 3 days, I gradually overcame my initial resistance. One exercise in particular was powerful for me. We were paired off with a partner, and it was our partner's job to ask us over and over, whose are you? For like 5 minutes, which is a long time to answer that question over and over and over again. As it turned out, there were many people, groups, and organizations to whom I felt like I belonged. I was my mother and father's son, my sister's brother. I was a minister connected and responsible to other ministers, a Unitarian Universalist connected and responsible to other Unitarian Universalists. And there were many more, and of course today I'd be adding that I'm a husband connected and responsible to my wife, and a father connected and responsible to my children. Part of what I think is uncomfortable about the questions, whose are we and whose am I, is that Unitarian Universalists tend to prize our individualism. And so we're not used to thinking of ourselves as a smaller part of a larger whole. The questions almost force a different and uncomfortable, perhaps, orientation. To try and answer the question, whose am I? You have to accept the supposition that you do in fact belong to someone else or some other group. It's not an I-centered perspective, it's an other or outward-centered perspective. Kind of like what Barbara Merritt suggested in our reading today was so important to us as human beings. Just as we do when we're young children, to allow ourselves to be held by something larger for comfort and healing. She wrote, after sharing about her rambunctious young son still settling in for nurture at the end of the day, that I suspect that meditation and prayer are motivated by the same instinct. In our prayers, we are nestling in with reality, adopting a stance that declares we trust what is out there and what is inside. In moments of meditation, she continues, we assume a certain confidence, a faith that what is ultimately friendly, capable of supporting our life, and able to restore us to our full strength and potential. In a posture of receptivity and dependency, we allow for the possibility that a power greater than ourselves will hold us, feeding our starving souls and give us peace. It was that last line in particular that connects for me with a whose am I question. In a posture of receptivity and dependency, we all We allow for the possibility that a power greater than ourselves will hold us, feeding our starving souls and give us peace. Sometimes our emphasis on individuality and Unitarian Universalism can lead to a sense that we need to do it all ourselves, to figure it all out, to handle it all on our own. At the very least, for me, a posture of receptivity and dependency is not one I accept readily or easily. And I wonder, why not? Why was I so uncomfortable with the whose am I question at that retreat? In Brené Brown's first definition of belonging, we don't really have to change anything at all to belong. We're loved just the way we are, rugged individualism and all, which is as it should be. But she also offers a definition of belonging as, quote, the innate human desire to be part of something larger than us. Whose am I asks us to consider what that something larger is, to take ourselves out of the center, being the center of our own universe, so that we might consider, to whom do I belong? To whom do we belong? A big chunk of that question, of the answer to that question, for those of us who gather here together, is that of course we belong to each other. The love that we offer as a community to each individual is expressed through individual connections most of the time, and so as we weave those connections, we end up belonging here and belonging together and belonging to each other. Not in an ownership or control kind of way, but in a I belong with you kind of way. This is a deeper kind of belonging, one that is not just a passive receiving of unconditional love, but the deeper interconnection that comes from the sharing of unconditional love. I actually want to share now a Christmas story by Nancy Dahlberg, which seemed to me the best way to illustrate all of this. And her story goes like this. It was Sunday, Christmas. Our family had spent the holidays in San Francisco with my husband's parents, but in order for us to be back at work on Monday, we found ourselves driving the 400 miles home to Los Angeles on Christmas Day. It's normally an 8-hour drive, but with the kids, it can be a 14-hour endurance test. When we could stand it no longer, we stopped for lunch in King City. Now, this little metropolis was made up of 6 gas stations and 3 sleazy diners. And it was into one of these diners that the 4 of us trooped, road-weary and saddle-sore. As I sat Eric, our 1-year-old, in a high chair, I looked around the room and wondered, what am I doing in this place? The restaurant was nearly empty, we were the only family, and ours were the only children. Everyone else was busy eating, talking quietly, aware perhaps that we were all somehow out of place on this special day, when even the cynical paused to reflect on peace and brotherhood. My reverie was interrupted when I heard Eric squeal with glee, "Hi there." 2 words he thought were one. "Hi there," he pounded his fat baby hands whack whack on the metal high chair tray, his face alive with excitement, eyes wide, gums bared in a toothless grin. He wriggled and chirped and giggled, and then I saw the source of his merriment, and my eyes could not take it in all at once. A tattered rag of a coat, obviously bought by someone else eons ago, dirty, greasy, and worn, baggy pants, both they and the zipper at half-mast over a spindly body, toes that poked out of would-be shoes, a shirt that had ring around the collar all over, and a face like none other, gums as bare as Eric's hair, uncombed, unwashed, and unbearable, whiskers too short to be called a beard, but way, way beyond a shadow, and a nose so varicose that it looked like a map of New York. I was too far away to smell him, but I knew he smelled, and his hands were waving in the air, flapping about on loose wrists. "Hi there, baby. Hi there, big boy. I see you, Buster." My husband and I exchanged a look that was a cross between "What do we do?" and "Poor devil." Eric continued to laugh and answer, "Hi, hi there." Every call was echoed. I noticed waitresses' eyebrows shoot to their foreheads and several people sitting near us ahemed out loud. This old geezer was creating a nuisance with my beautiful baby. I shoved a cracker at Eric and he pulverized it on the tray. I whispered, "Why me?" under my breath. Our meal came and the cacophony continued. Now the old bum was shouting from across the room, "Do you know patty cake? Attaboy, do you know peekaboo? Hey, look, he knows peekaboo!" Nobody thought it was cute. The guy was a drunk and a disturbance, and I was embarrassed. My husband, Dennis, was humiliated. Even our 6-year-old said, "Why is that old man talking so loud?" We ate in silence. All except Eric, who was running through his repertoire for the admiring applause of a Skid Row bum. Finally, I had enough. I turned the high chair. Eric screamed and clambered around to face his old buddy. Now I was mad. Dennis went to pay the check, imploring me to, quote, "get Eric and meet me in the parking lot." I trundled Eric out of the high chair and looked toward the exit. The old man sat poised and waiting. his chair directly between me and the door. Lord, just help me get out of here before he speaks to me or Eric. I bolted for the door. It soon became obvious that both the Lord and Eric had other plans. As I drew closer to the man, I turned my back, walking sidestep to him and any air he might be breathing. As I did so, Eric, all the while with his eyes riveted to his best friend, leaned far over my arm, reaching with both his arms in a baby's pick-me-up position. In a split second of balancing my baby and turning to counter his weight, I came eye to eye with the old man. Eric was lunging for him, arms spread wide. The bum's eyes both asked and implored, "Would you let me hold your baby?" There was no need for me to answer, since Eric propelled himself from my arms to the man's. Suddenly, a very old man and a very young baby were involved in a love relationship. Eric laid his tiny head upon the man's ragged shoulder. The man's eyes closed, and I saw tears hover beneath his lashes. His aged hands, full of grime and pain and hard labor, gently, ever so gently, cradled my baby's bottom and stroked his back. I stood awestruck. The old man rocked and cradled Eric in his arms for a moment, and then his eyes opened and set squarely on mine. He said in a firm and commanding voice, "You take care of this baby." Somehow I managed, "I will," from a throat that contained a stone. He pried Eric from his chest, unwillingly, longingly, as though he was in pain. "God bless you, man. You've given me my Christmas gift." I said nothing more than a muttered thanks. With Eric back in my arms, I ran for the car. Dennis wondered why I was crying and holding Eric so tightly, and why I was saying, "My God, oh God, forgive me." Part of what's so delightful about this story is the connection between one-year-old Eric and the hard-on-his-luck old man. They didn't know each other, wouldn't have known each other at all if Eric's parents had anything to do with it. And yet, for a moment, they belonged together. They belonged to each other. And so I wonder sometimes if Barbara Merritt is right. I clearly get that we human beings can belong to each other one-on-one and as part of a larger community. I wonder, though, if there is power to meditation and prayer, power and a posture of receptivity and dependence. Now, I've personally never been a big one for prayer. It just hasn't been something that's spoken to me on a personal level as a meaningful spiritual practice. I have to say, though, that the summer I served as a chaplain at a hospital in Boston, my job required me to pray quite a bit every day, many times a day usually. And I did it willingly, knowing that it was meaningful for the people I was helping, but figuring it didn't do a lot for me. The interesting thing, though, that I didn't anticipate was that shortly after my chaplaincy ended, I realized that I missed praying. It turns out that there was indeed, even for me, a skeptic, someone who didn't put a lot of stock in it, a meaningful connection and experience that happened when I was praying regularly on behalf of other folks. I don't quite know how to put it into words to this day, what exactly it was that I missed, but I definitely noticed a difference and felt an absence. My own theological stance is that I think there's an energy in the world and in the universe, an energy in all living things, and maybe in all things, and I call that energy love with a capital L. I don't think it's an active energy that does anything or intervenes anywhere. I just believe it's there, accessible to me and to us. And I call that love God. Usually carefully, usually in context, so people know what I mean, but that's what I call it. And it's weird to think for me to think about belonging to that love, perhaps because I'm still applying the ownership model of belonging instead of the Eric and old man model of connecting. Until it started falling apart, there was a banner that used to hang right over here on the wall from our old Universalist church that said, "God is love." Maybe there is power in a posture of receptivity and dependency, a posture of receptivity and dependency towards love. Maybe uncomfortable, it's uncomfortable now for me to say it, but maybe it's worth a shot. Whether you consider love as the love of this community or love as the love that some consider God, what would it look like for you to adopt a posture of receptivity and dependency towards the love that is there for you? We started today by saying together, I am loved just as I am with all my imperfections. What would it look like to each day intentionally set ourselves in a posture of receptivity and maybe even a posture of dependency to receive the love that is out there for each and every one of us? Friends, as we go about our days, as we go about our weeks, I surely hope that we have places that we know where we belong, that you know that you belong, where you know that you are loved exactly as you are, imperfections and all. And I ask you to consider, contrary as it might be to some of our instincts, for it's certainly contrary to my instincts, I ask you to consider what it might be like to try to adopt a posture of receptivity and dependency. Whose are you? To whom do you belong?